entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hi there, welcome in. It is Sunday morning. It's the 12th day of January, and this is the Best of Downtown. Brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell with you, looking back at some of our favorite conversations from the previous week. And some good stuff for you, as always. We'll talk with University of Maine professor and author Michael Sokolow, comedy legend Gilbert Gottfried a little bit later on. But we get things underway by talking about a music legend with a radio legend. Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll, would have turned 85 earlier this week. We thought there was no one better to talk about the king than the king of radio, the humble, but nonetheless, mighty John Marshall. Do you remember the first time you heard Elvis?
Yes, it would have been on the Ed Sullivan Show, the first time I saw him. I'm not sure it's the first time I heard him, but that's the first time I saw him. You know, the great thing about Elvis, at that time, every generation that's grown up since then has had some form of rock and roll in their livelihood, whether it's hard rock, classic rock, grunge, punk, whatever. But with us, who were growing up in that Elvis generation or the baby boomers, we had nothing to compare it to, nothing like it. So John Lennon said, before Elvis, there was nothing. And that's true. So to have for him come along at that time, it was a perfect storm. He had the voice, he had the looks, he had the charisma. And he had Colonel Tom Parker. A lot of people don't like Colonel Tom Parker, think he didn't really help Elvis that much and took too much of his money. I think he made some bad moves, but overall, I think the Colonel had a lot to do with it.
Now, what was your impression when you heard him for the very first time and saw him on television?
Well, I think I was like everybody else with, what's this? You know, haven't seen anything like this before. I remember my father reacting, what's Sullivan doing? What'd you get that guy on his show for? you know, the parents didn't like him, so we loved him.
It's interesting because Sullivan, though, went out of his way to, I think, reassure the parents that this was a fine young man who loved his parents and loved his God, and despite what he was doing on stage, was a good guy, and they could trust him for their kids to listen to that music, and they'd be okay.
Yeah, in the beginning, Sullivan swore he'd never have him on his show. But after he saw the ratings with Steve Allen and Jimmy Dorsey, the Dorsey brothers, he changed his mind.
Now, Elvis, in many ways, people say he had a couple of different phases to his career, pre-Army and post-Army, certainly. Do you think there was a drop-off in the quality of music when he came back from the Army?
I think there was generally a drop-off in pure rock and roll starting in the early 60s. So Elvis just went along with it. But I remember in 1965, when Elvis turned 30, how the press went nuts saying, wow, Elvis is 30. That's the end of his career, and that's the end of rock and roll. So now he's 85. So it's kind of strange.
Yeah, and then at the ripe old age of, 33, had that unbelievable comeback concert on NBC and a real resurgence in the career and some of his best music in the late 60s and early 70s.
You know, I remember that very well because I was in the Army at the time, basic training in Missouri, Fort Leonard Wood. I purposely fouled up so I could get KP to clean the day room so I could watch TV to see Elvis's special. And some guy above me didn't like it, so he switched off the Elvis thing and went to something else, and I was very disappointed. I not only had KP, but I didn't see Elvis.
We're talking with Mighty John Marshall here on Downtown. Would rock and roll have been as big as it's become without somebody like Elvis to lead the way?
Well, it's really tough to say. I don't think so, but you know, it's really an unknown. Rock and roll was coming in full force. Elvis just happened to be the catalyst. He just happened to be, as I say, the perfect storm with the looks, the voice, the charisma, and the name, Elvis. If his name had been Bob, you know, it just wouldn't have had the same magic.
And, of course, he had the ability to appeal to so many people, and part of that's because he loved so many different types of music. He loved rock and roll, but he loved rhythm and blues, gospel, country music.
And gospel is the only form of music that he ever won a Grammy for. Won a Grammy for rock and roll or country, which is rather ironic. So Elvis, I think, won 3 Grammys for his gospel records.
Now, you know the value of records more than anybody else in the world. What's the most valuable Elvis single?
Well, probably it was a hit in 1962 called Good Luck Charm. It's also on a 45, but it's also on a 7-inch 33, which means it's the size of a 45, but it plays at the speed of an album. And the regular 45 worth up to about $40 with its picture sleeve. But the 7-inch 33 with the small hole in the middle of the record rather than the larger 45 RPM hole with picture sleeve up to $20,000.
Wow, wow. Now, how about the early Sun records?
You know, at about 15, 20 years ago, they were selling for $5,000 a piece. But with the advent of the Internet, it brought a lot more of them to the public and easier to attain. And so they actually went down in value, where today each one is worth about $1,000.
Wow. And Elvis albums, which one's the most pricey out there?
Probably his Christmas album, his first Christmas album from 1957. If you have a black vinyl copy, it's worth up to about $600. Mm. But if you have a copy where the vinyl is red, and we found one a year ago doing a radio interview where somebody called up and said, I've got that, and they emailed me a picture, and in fact, they did have it. Red vinyl on that original Christmas album up to $15,000.
Wow. Now, you must have been on the air because, as I recall, the news broke late afternoon in August of 77. You must have been on the air when word came out that Elvis had died.
I was. I remember the newsman running into the control room saying, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? Elvis is dead. I said, get out of here. But then, you know, everybody started calling and saying, did you hear Elvis is dead? And, oh, this is not good. So, yeah, and he was going to be in Portland, of course, that night.
That's right, yeah.
And Colonel Parker was in town already. He was at a local radio station with Bob Anderson, who was a friend of mine. And the colonel, on his way to the station, had stopped at an auto parts store and purchased some spark plugs. And he wanted to go on the air and sell the spark plugs, saying they were from Elvis's Cadillac, $100 a piece. So the colonel never stopped. He was just a great marketing genius. And I talked to Waylon Jennings about a month after Elvis died. I got to interview Waylon, and we were talking about Elvis. And he said, you know, I talked to the colonel a week after Elvis died, and I said to the colonel, what are you going to do now that Elvis is dead? He looked me right in the eye and he said, boy, Elvis ain't dead. he's going to continue to make money.
And he did, absolutely. I think even now, I think I saw a ranking not too long ago that Elvis still in the top 3 each year in earnings among dead celebrities.
Yes, he's made more money since his death than he did prior to his death. That's true. So yeah. Elvis continues on. I mean, everybody knows Elvis, whether they're, you know, 6 or 96, they know who Elvis is.
What's your favorite Elvis song?
Well, I think Don't Be Cruel. You know, that was his favorite Elvis song, and I like that too. And I got a great trivia question for you.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
What movie star appeared in more Elvis movies than any other movie star? Female.
Female? Wow.
What female star appeared in more Elvis movies than any other female?
Yeah, we both are. Ann Margaret would be our first guess, I think.
Yeah, no.
No? Okay.
Some people would say Shelley Fabre.
Yeah.
She was in 3 Elvis movies. But Raquel Welch.
Wow.
Never had a speaking part. They always put her in the background with the dancers and and just because she looks good.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I love
that's
it.
Kind of a trick question, but Raquel Welch appeared in more Elvis movies than any other super female star.
That's why we turned to Mighty John Marshall, getting you that info that nobody else has got. Hey, Mighty, appreciate you coming on to celebrate Elvis's 85th. Always great to talk with you. And by the way, we love having you on every Friday for this day in rock and roll history. And thanks so much for being a part of what we do.
Well, thank you, Rich. Happy New Year.
Mighty John Marshall sharing his thoughts on the king, Elvis Presley, here on the Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. When we come back, a lengthy conversation with University of Maine professor Michael Sokolow as we cover everything from the fires in Australia to the upcoming presidential election. It's next here on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free Maine State inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
You love going out to eat and saving money. Well, the Ground Round in Bangor has different weekly specials every day of the week. Plus, happy hour at the Ground Round is way more than just 1 hour. During happy hour, you can get an appetizer for just $1.99 when you get another app at full price. And full mugs of Bud Light, Coors, and Miller Lite are just $2.99. Happy hour at the Ground Round is every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. and from 9 p.m. to close. And Sunday all day is happy hour too. Want more details? Visit online at groundround.com.
ClearPoint Capital is excited to be the official financial advisor sponsor of the Maine Black Bears. At ClearPoint Capital, our client relationships are built upon trust, proactive service, state-of-the-art planning tools, and a disciplined investment process. ClearPoint Capital is your financial advocate. Your success is our success. See what our team can do for you and your family. ClearPoint Capital and the Maine Black Bears. Now that's a winning combination.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. Call us today at 307-7718.
Winter's here. Winter's cold weather and snow is finally arriving. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street in Bangor, wants you to be ready for it. Bring your vehicle in right now and have it checked before the really cold weather kicks in. They'll check the battery, antifreeze, shocks, alignment, and don't forget the snow tires. Don't wait. For once, get ahead of the really cold winter weather. Make your appointment today. Call Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, or check them out on the web at bangortire.com. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, Bangor. More than just a tire store.
Rebates have doubled. Yep, doubled for our most efficient heat pump systems. At Valley Home Services, get $1,000 off your first system and $500 off your second. And don't wait for the rebate. Valley Home Services provides rebates instantly. With combined savings and financing options, now is the best time to have Valley Home Services install your heat pump system. Double rebates. Call now for your free consultation and start saving up to 50% on heating and cooling. Valley Home Services, home is our middle name. And we're back here on Downtown, the best of for your Sunday morning. We always enjoy it when Michael Sokolow, professor at the University of Maine, author of the book 6 Minutes in Berlin, joins us. Michael was in studio earlier this week to talk about a lot of things, including the bushfires in Australia and what might go into covering and reporting on the upcoming 2020 presidential election. The last time you were on, it was by phone from Australia.
That's right. It was Canberra, Australia, and I called you from the day ahead.
That's right. Yeah, you were there for the semester, and it sounded like you had a wonderful experience there. And you can obviously, as a result of that, really identify with the devastation that they're going through now.
Yeah, I'm following all the news that I followed down there, and it's just incredible. I mean, I don't think we're getting any sense of the scale here or the size. I mean, we're hearing numbers like a billion animals, but. If you actually knew the geographic locations, it would be mind-boggling. I mean, to give you one sense, we used to go to this beach from Canberra about 2 hours away, and everything, I mean, just the devastation between the city, it would be like Bangor to Seals Harbor or Bar Harbor. Imagine if all the highways were closed, thousands of homes were just gone, and you couldn't, there was no way in or out for anybody.
Well, and someone did an overlay on social media, placing Australia over the United States and then showing all of the fires just to to really illustrate the enormity of this, and it's just hard to grasp.
It's hard to grasp for a bunch of different reasons, like not just the geographic scale, but also the air is so bad. It's so bad that you can go on YouTube, for instance, and see people driving around with their respirators on. And so we'll never really know the full cost of this in terms of the health of the people who are breathing this stuff. I mean, everything's closed in Canberra.
Right.
I mean, like Canberra, where I lived, Australian National University, University of Canberra, all the schools are shut down. And you see the restaurants, nobody's going out to eat. The whole economic situation has come to a standstill.
And you would hope, but I don't think it's going to happen, you would hope that people would see this as yet another wake-up call that climate change is real. This is, the science is real. This is, it's not a fantasy.
Yeah, Australia was already far ahead of us in understanding climate change.
Well, except their prime minister, right?
Well, no, even the right wing, he supports coal so much, Scott Morrison, ScoMo, but even they only want to talk about the cost of mediation. They admit it's happening because in Australia you cannot ignore it. But one of the things about their prime minister that's fascinating to me is he comes from public relations. We've never had a president who actually comes from public relations, not from broadcasting. I mean, he was on The Apprentice or anything, but public relations. He is so good, their prime minister, that I don't know if you saw this. Everything he's saying now is so market tested. So he's saying, now is not the time to talk about blame and responsibility. But at the same time, he's saying, this is really an arson question. Why are we lighting these fires? He's misdirecting attention perfectly. I mean, as a scholar of propaganda, I study this and I write about it. He is so talented.
Wow. What's the global cost, not financial cost, but what's the impact of this going to be?
It's fascinating. I'm not sure if you consider the scale and size of it, I'm not sure we'll ever figure it out for a whole bunch of different reasons. I mean, one very simple reason is there aren't very many people in Australia. It's a massive continent. You have basically the New York City metropolitan area of population over a continent the size of the United States. So there's tens of thousands of acres that are just disappearing, and nobody knows the long range, cost that it'll be.
And spinoffs that we don't even think about. Originally, Eric Meehan, Bangor Wine and Cheese, was in the other day talking about the fact that Australia has been such a huge wine producer over the years, and a devastating blow to that.
Absolutely. And, you can't believe the statistics you're getting because the government is self-interested. So, for instance, they say only 25 people have died so far. It's many more than that. If you go to, for instance, Reddit Canberra or Reddit Australia or places like this, they have cases of people on respirators who the particulate of the air is so bad that people are dying from that, and they don't, that doesn't count because they're not burned up. They didn't lose their house in a fire. It's just bad air they're breathing. And so that's the kind of costs that we don't see that are just horrific.
And why, and this is not unique, but why is it that Americans just don't seem to be very concerned about this? Is it as simple as, well, it's all the way on the other side of the world?
Well, that's what drives me crazy. I kept on Twitter, I kept saying, hey, why is American media not paying attention, not understanding it? I think that's the first thing. A professor at Harvard, that was his reply to me, was, hey, this is happening 10,000 miles from America. But the other thing I think, and it would be fascinating to see if this ever happened somewhere in Europe or the United States, I don't think the scale of what's happening is. I don't think we can imagine it as a narrative. So, for instance, you might have heard of they're going to cull in 5 days 10,000 feral camels in South Australia. I don't know if you saw this. It's going to start this Saturday. And it's because the feral camels are drinking the humans' water supply. They've had a drought for several years. They need as much water as they can get to fight these fires and everything. And so between this Saturday and next Tuesday, 10,000 feral camels in South Australia are going to be shot. From helicopters, because there's no way to get to them otherwise.
Right.
I mean, how do you imagine that?
No, you can't.
You can't go in the Everglades. We're not going to have a situation where you go in the Everglades or go into, northern Maine and need to cull animals like that. So that's what I mean when I say I don't think the scale is understandable to American journalists. The other thing that isn't understandable is how hot it is there. I don't know if you've heard, but, Penrith, which is a suburb of Sydney, hit 120 degrees.
Oh.
So this is separate from the fire.
Wow.
The smoke is coming in. You can't breathe. You're running electricity. They're not even running the brows. This is mind-boggling. I mean, Americans can't imagine 120 degrees for 4 or 5 days straight.
No, not at all. We're talking with Michael Sokolow here. on Downtown. Let's shift into the world of politics. And you were telling us before we came on, you've got an exciting assignment coming up. You're going to the Iowa caucuses.
That's right. A nonprofit out of Los Angeles that does educational and civic education called Kid Unity has invited me to be part of the program. And so I'll be in Des Moines on Monday, February 3rd for the caucus.
Wow. All right. So let me ask you this then. Is the caucus still the best way to go when it comes to choosing candidates? Because it tends to be primarily activists, and they're often at the extremes in each political party.
Well, I've only physically been to one caucus before here in Maine in 2012, just to look. It was Republican, and I wasn't a Republican participant. And it's exactly as you say, right? Because you have the multiple votes, you have the call to order, you have this and that. And I found it fascinating. I talked to my colleague, Professor Amy Freed at University of Maine, and we ended up writing a piece on it because Ron Paul won. There was no question that Ron Paul won the most votes in the caucus in 2012. And the Republican Party literally took, through superdelegates, through all this political maneuvering, and made the winner Mitt Romney. And to me, I'd never seen anything like that before. It was fascinating. So I wrote a piece for Reuters on it, co-authored with, because also I didn't understand how it could happen. She had to explain it to me, so that's how we are.
Well, it is the ultimate in political deal-making at the grassroots level.
I mean, another example is the Republicans in Iowa in 2016 did it by voting, and the Democrats did it by caucusing. And when you look at the actual numbers of 2016, they're fascinating. Ted Cruz won Iowa by 6,000 votes over, and he won more delegates than Donald Trump. Yet on the Democratic side, it was this brutal fight having to do with proportionality in the caucus. And the final result, nobody remembers this, was Hillary Clinton 49.9 and Sanders 49.3. It was a 0.6% difference. And I'll tell you, journalists, I don't think, report it well because I don't remember Sanders coming that close that early on.
Now, we were also talking about this before we came on the 19th, 10 days away, the New York Times is going to announce who they're endorsing for the Democratic nomination, and it's going to be quite a production.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. By the way, the author of the piece who announced it today is Kathleen Kingsbury. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner who used to be at the Boston Globe, and we had her up here at UMaine for Pulitzer Week a couple years
ago.
She's great. But in her rollout on Twitter, she said there's going to be a television show. There's going to be full video, full transcripts of every interview they do in the boardroom with each of the candidates. And there's going to be a podcast explaining how they made their decisions. There's going to be interviews with the board members as well as with the candidates. It's an absolutely massive, I've never seen anything like it, multimedia extravaganza. I'm curious who they'll choose, but the rollout itself as a production is fascinating.
And why do you think they're going to this extent to explain their decision?
Well, there's a couple interesting thoughts jumping around at Twitter. One is that their podcast is doing very well, their daily podcast, but their TV and their video is not doing as well. And that they're going to try and leverage this, basically take that podcast audience and feed them to get more video and more stuff like that. But I also wonder if this is what happens when you move from advertising to a subscription base. In other words, they have to please their Democratic readership in new ways that they didn't have to previously.
Right.
I mean, the truth is, if they are as balanced as they say they are, or as they are open, you know, independent, neutral, objective, you choose the words, they would endorse somebody in the Republican primary as
exactly.
well.
Exactly, yeah.
But there's no announcement of that yet. Perhaps that'll happen.
And is it, because I can't even recall, is it common practice to endorse a candidate in the primaries?
It's actually not. And it's not for a bunch of really good reasons. I just finished Brian Rosenwald's book called Talk Radio America. And in it, he says that Rush Limbaugh does not endorse in the primary for a bunch of different reasons, even when he makes it very, very clear. Like everybody forgets, Rush Limbaugh basically said, vote Ted Cruz in 2016.
Right.
But he doesn't do it because it doesn't work. And when Rush Limbaugh can't deliver, his irrelevance is made clear. And Limbaugh's smart enough to know this. And if you look at who the Republicans have nominated since Limbaugh became gigantic, like Bob Dole, George W. Bush, McCain, and then Mitt Romney, none of them were the Limbaugh alternative.
Well, and you've written about this in regards to Fox News and the perception that people have of their influence and that maybe it's not as great, at least when it comes to choosing candidates or electing candidates, as we might think.
Rosenwald's book is really interesting on this because you get to see Republican politicians really struggling with this, like Speaker John Boehner and Paul Ryan. And Republicans who are serious about governance, who are thinking about how to pass bills and how to make America better in certain ways, quote unquote, more effective governance, let's put it that way, are being misled by the perception that right-wing talk radio is stronger than it really is, because it doesn't show up in the voting booth, even in the primaries for Republicans.
And even Fox News, despite their numbers, and yes, they're in many ways the most watched news, but that's still not a lot of people.
Let's put it this way. Fox News on a very good night gets about 3.5 million viewers. On an average night, ABC World News Tonight gets 8.6 million, okay? We're a country of 330 million. So 99.7% of the citizens of the United States are not watching Fox News on any given night. But it's this perception. That's the problem. People who work in the media constantly talk about Murdoch, constantly talk about Fox News. But if we didn't give it the oxygen that we do, I'm not even going to say it has the influence it does, because I don't think it has quite the influence it says it does.
So, Michael, what is the value of an endorsement, whether it's from a newspaper or whether this week with Julian Castro announcing his support for Elizabeth Warren? If not in bringing people to that side, surely there's some value.
Well, I might be giving away my column here, and I might, because I've been asked, just disclosure, I've been asked by an editor to write on it. And I was DMing with Jack Schaefer of Politico today about this kind of thing. And so I might be giving something away here. It might ruin Jack's column.
It's just us, so no one's going to hear it anyway.
That's good. But here's the real deal. It's been studied, newspaper endorsements. And it's called the third person effect. And what it is the endorsement itself does not influence people. It influences very, very few people. But what it does is it creates the illusion that other people are now going to vote. And so people read the endorsement and they say, well, wait a minute, this candidate has more voters than I thought they did. And that it's called the bandwagon effect, and it's been studied. And that is
speaking
the power
of propaganda.
that is the power of an endorsement, is it convinces people that other people are going to vote. And it's the idea of I need to get with the other people that's influential. It's not this newspaper has authority. And by the way, if you ever want to check the authority of newspapers to swing an election, look at 2016. Donald Trump, I believe, was endorsed by 3 or 4 newspapers, none bigger. I think the biggest was in San Mateo, California, or San Marco, California, something like that.
Wow.
And Hillary Clinton had over 200 endorsements.
Now, we still don't know the impact that Facebook and social media had on the last election, but I think it's very interesting, the news that they plan absolutely no change to their policy when it comes to politicians advertising and targeting people.
I'm a cynic. When it comes to Facebook, Facebook is constantly apologizing, and which tells you all you really need to know about them. But also something else that you need to know about them is that Peter Thiel is on their board of directors.
Right.
You know, and so this is the world that they consider. I mean, it even disturbs me when they say, "Oh, we're going to change the ad policies. We're going to be more careful about advertising," because everybody knows the trolls and the bots aren't buying ads.
Right.
They're creating this. Twitter is also disturbing. I like Twitter a little better, but it's disturbing on one thing. You know that right now, it would be very easy for Twitter to identify and get rid of these trolls and these bots, but it would hurt their growth numbers. It would hurt their engagement numbers. They would get less advertising revenue. It would make them less influential. And so everything about the system is geared towards keeping the trolls and bots alive. You know, that's the real problem.
I was reading a while back, and you may recall her name, the woman who is essentially in charge of Facebook News and has talked about her efforts to keep everything on the straight and narrow, but then she's got this separate life and identity that's very biased in one direction.
Yes, Campbell Brown.
Yes,
Campbell Brown, a former mainstream news organization, news person. Facebook isn't, the thing that cracks me up is back in the middle of the 20th century, the people running CBS, NBC, and ABC would say, oh, we're right down the middle. You know, we're objective. We're in this kind of consensus thing. Facebook's not that smart yet. Like, if Facebook really put it together, that's what they would do. They would say, oh, we can't do this or that because we really need to show all of you. We need to blah, blah, blah. And this. No, they exactly like this Campbell Brown. You know, they need to pretend they're more effective than they are. I know that sounds strange, but if, in the advertising world and the metrics they work in, they can't play the naive empiricist that the guys running CBS, NBC, and ABC did back in the 1970s.
Were the networks, and of course you have a family connection there, but were the networks down the middle, or was that some well-crafted PR?
I'm invested in this. So my father was the producer of the CBS Evening News. So I'll phrase it this way, with the caveat and disclaimer that I'm self-interested here. I think the level of professionalism involved was much, much higher. I think they were liberal. My father was a liberal. Walter Cronkite was a liberal. Everybody around him. I think they were liberal in certain ways. Let's be clear about that. But they were conservative in other ways. But I think the level of professionalism, the idea that we have to be accurate, was much higher back then.
Well, and my perception, of course, growing up in that time period, first of all, it was all we knew. And you didn't have 24-hour news channels. The sources for media information were much more limited. But I always viewed it as an early and young consumer of the news as the number one objective being speaking truth to power. And that wasn't based on political party. It was based on that old adage, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing we forget is the news shows. And even when CNN started, it was like this. You have such little time that they were basically wire services. Where could we get the pictures and video from, and how could we do this? But the problem was they were making a lot of money and they were investing it in bureaus around the world. Today, all these corporations, they'll just take any video. I mean, you watch your local news now and it's something you saw on Twitter or Reddit. It's, a squirrel water skiing or some kind of viral video that they got for cheap. It costs money to produce really good news, and I don't think the will is there anymore.
But you've written, too, and I found this very interesting. Sometimes there's a perception with the networks, the major networks, that news is a loss leader, and you've said nothing could be further from the truth.
No, that's my theory. I mean, my theory is they're not making enough money, because back in the days when the CBS Evening News, here's a little fact. The single highest advertising vehicle in the United States in 1966 was the Huntley-Brinkley Report. It made $27 million. The CBS Evening News was second. It made $25 million. And when you have that much money, you can go after the president. You can tell the American people that, Vietnam isn't working out.
Right.
And your president is a crook, despite what you say. When you have that much money, your corporation is going to back you up. When you're in a perilous state and you're relying on a different kind of revenue basis and people can boycott you, and all kinds of things, it makes it much scarier, I think.
And even at the local level, and I don't think it's changed that much since I was working in local TV, that was always the top dollar for local advertising was to be in those local newscasts.
Yeah, and, it's interesting. We were talking about WABI before and Hildreth Communications. When they sold to Gray, this is Channel 5 in Bangor for people around here, I didn't realize this, but did you know that Hildreth was the last original television license owner in the entire United States?
I didn't know that.
To sell to a national chain.
Well, I remember working with Hottie Hildreth, who just passed away recently, and the Hildreth family, and that was a time we've gotten away from that, when you had family-owned broadcast companies. Now, we're one of the last here before the conglomerates came in, largely in radio, but now even more so in television. And that's a whole can of worms we could discuss another time, whether it's what the Cox companies do or what Sinclair Broadcasting is doing.
Sure, sure. But, a really conservative person up here in this market would say, wait a minute, there was a Governor Hildreth who leveraged that TV station. So, LBJ, everybody forgets. How did LBJ get rich? And how did LBJ... Right. Spread his money around. He became the Senate Majority Leader in his second term in the Senate, which is unheard of. And it was because he was taking all this money out of his radio station in Austin, Texas.
I want to ask you about this. Portland Press Herald announced recently that starting in March, their Monday edition will be online only. No more print, no more delivery of Monday newspapers. Clearly a sign of things to come in the newspaper industry.
Yeah, I have to be careful about this because I was on the board of the Maine Press Association. And my student, Casey Kelly, who works at the University of Maine, wrote an excellent piece for Columbia Journalism Review on what's happening in Maine. We're the state that has only two daily newspaper owners.
Right.
And the only state in America. And so it's absolutely fascinating. Everybody's looking at us as sort of the canary in the coal mine because every daily newspaper in the state, except for the Bangor Daily News, is owned by a single person, Reed Brower. And so I don't know. I know that the printing company is subsidizing the actual newspaper, but without knowing the numbers, I can't say. I will say this. I have great confidence in the people who put together the Portland Press Herald. I mean, and Maine Today Media. It's not called Maine Today Media, but Lisa DeSisto and all the editors and the columnists, the people like Bill Nemitzer, they're
absolutely
terrific. They're national level. And I did hear that they were not going to have layoffs as part of this cutback. And so that's good. That's, if that's true, that's really good.
Did newspapers misjudge what would become the rapid growth of the internet and realize fully what was likely to happen in their industry? Are they playing catch up now?
There's a great podcast with John Skipper of ESPN talking about this with Bill Simmons. And they say, absolutely. They say, look, how did newspapers allow the Village Voice and the alternative papers to come in and eat their lunch on entertainment advertising? How did Craigslist come in? How did newspapers miss, X, Y, and Z as you go down the line? But I don't know. And the other idea is that, wait a minute, newspapers were a product that had a 300-year
It's true.
Run of profitability, which no product ever has had. And so, it's whether they run their course. So I'm not sure yet. I'm hoping for the best because I'm an old newspaper fan.
Me too. And I still get a couple of Sunday papers delivered to my house because I still love that feel of opening up the paper and drinking my coffee and folding it the right way and going through all that. I don't know. This is not the death of newspapers by any stretch. It's a different format, but it certainly changes things. And you talked about it earlier with the New York Times, because now you've got to offer something more for those subscribers, more original content that you can't find if you get that print edition.
Yeah, and I went to a fascinating talk once where they were saying you have to start gearing the news in the newspaper for people buying it as a special thing. So, for instance, one of the things they said is local high school sports have to start having more names and numbers. They have to have more data so that the family can buy three clippings, three copies and
right.
clippings and stuff. And, maybe that'll work. I don't know. But there are these theories. And some papers have solved it. Some papers are doing – the Ellsworth American did not put everything on the web and did better than most newspapers in America in that way. So I'm not sure.
Well, it's a fascinating time. Michael, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming in today. Hopefully we can catch up with you when you're in Iowa.
Yeah, maybe I'll call in. I'll let you give you. Maybe I'll break the embargo, give you an early return.
That's Michael Sokolow with us here on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. When we return, comedy legend Gilbert Gottfried. And a little look behind the curtain with Gilbert as well. It's next on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind. Identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Central Street Farmhouse, downtown Bangor, for the best home brewing ingredients, equipment, and advice that you'll find anywhere. Plus, make your own wine right in the store. How does that work? Pick a wine kit, make an appointment, and whip up 6 gallons of the best wine you'll ever taste in less than 30 minutes. 2 months later, come back to bottle it and take it home. They offer these wine classes every day they're open, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Call 992-4454 or see them on Facebook to find out more.
What makes a community thrive? The people who live in it. When you use your First National Bank Visa debit card at participating local businesses, you save on everyday purchases while supporting the people who work day in and day out to make your town a vibrant, unique community. Receive cash back on purchases and support the local businesses that make our communities thrive. Bank local, buy local. Learn more at dreamfirstrewards.com. First National Bank. Dream first because you can. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
You look like an angel.
Look like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Talk like an angel. But I got wise. Disguise. Oh, yes, you are.
celebrating Elvis here on the Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. Our next guest, is he a devil in disguise? Well, perhaps. An interesting life. Gilbert Gottfried, who's been making people laugh for more than 3 decades now. His work as a stand-up comedian, an actor, a voiceover artist, and a podcast host as well. And we got to hear Carrie in many ways from both Gilberts. The persona of Gilbert Gottfried, and then he dropped that a little bit to talk about the making of the documentary and his home life, and it was very interesting.
It was a great conversation, and yeah, I think especially comics are used to calling in, and they just are going to do a quick drop with a radio station, and they do a little taste of their act to get people there. And then he realized we were having a conversation and interested in more than just his act, and opened up a little bit.
Yeah, well, listen for yourself. By the way, Gilbert coming to Maine, he'll be at 49 Franklin. That's over in Rumford on January 30th. Our conversation with Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, see, I'm legendary. That means in the middle of this interview, I could drop dead.
I want to know who's put together your schedule, a very shrewd, to make your way here to Maine in the dead of winter.
Yeah, that's anything that could kill me, they put together that way. I always wind up in winter. I get filled up with, like, either, you know, Midwest, Canada. It's that's always like any place where the weather could have killed the dinosaurs. that's the weather I get put into.
We'll try and make it extra cold when you're here. I understand that your fantasy, if I get this right, quite often is that you're standing backstage waiting to go on, and a club owner tells you that no need to go on because of a catastrophe.
Yeah, my fantasy, I'll be waiting backstage, they're about to introduce me, and I always think, boy, if the manager came back and said, you know, there's been a flood or a fire on stage, we can't have, the show's been canceled, here's your check, and we've got you on the next flight out. That is my fantasy.
And yet you spend an awful lot of time on the road. What do you like most about being on the road?
When they give me the check at the end of the weekend. Yeah, I can't even hide the fact anymore. I'd love to say, oh, it's for the art. Nah, when they give me the check.
All right, forget art. I want to talk about a few things from your past. You've had such a remarkable career, but we were chatting before the show here. Carrie and I, both huge fans of Up All Night. That was such a breakthrough and such a way to showcase your talents.
Up All Night was one of those. Basically, I was, without the ghoul makeup, a late night ghoul, and that I was introducing bad movies. And they were all like TNA movies, but with all the TNA cut out of them. So you could really concentrate on the plot and dialogue.
You also, of course, then were so successful in your role in Aladdin, because I have to think some executive at Disney must have said, who's the perfect guy to get involved in a Disney film? Well, Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, well, my career has always walked a tightrope in between early morning children's programming and hardcore porn.
See, that's a balance not many people can achieve.
Yeah. So it's always been good. They said, oh, that guy who tells the aristocrat show, we'll get him to be in Disney.
We're talking with Gilbert Gottfried here on Downtown. We're huge fans of Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast. I love everything about it. We've had a lot of similar guests on the show, like Stephen Bishop, Ann Serling, Jeff Abraham, and a guy who's become a great friend of our show. I was so impressed with him hearing John Davidson on your podcast, because he was not the guy I imagined him to be.
Totally a surprise to me, too. and you know, a happy surprise. And we had been after him for the longest time, and he kept saying no, because I think he thought we were going to bring him on the show and just make fun of him or stuff. And he turned out to be an amazing guest. And he thanked us for it. He, sent us notes saying that he's so glad he did it. He was so excited about the new interest in his career now. But it's like his father was a preacher, but he himself is an atheist. It was a fascinating interview.
Yeah, and he told us that then you went to see him in person when he performed live in New York City.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I went there with Paul Schaefer. We both watched him. And, with Paul Schaefer and with Barbara Feldon, another former guest from my podcast, who was Agent 99 on Get Smart. We all saw him at that show.
And you've said, and I think it's accurate, your podcast, it's like an episode of The Love Boat.
Yeah, it's like the way they used to have The Love Boat or Fantasy Island, and there'd be these people that popped up that you swore were dead, and then you see them there, and they're older, and they're just as good as they ever were.
You mentioned that you and your producers had tried to get Davidson on for a while before he finally agreed. Who's the person that you haven't been able to get on that you are still working on, that, you know, that the one that you really want to get that hasn't come on yet?
Oh, there's a couple. I always feel scared to mention them because I feel like that'll be the total jinx.
Mm.
Of course, there's been other people, because of the age group we're dealing in, we will ask them to do the show, they agree, and then they die 2 days later. I was originally going to call the podcast the Before It's Too Late Show.
Well, we thought we were the leaders in whatever you call them, nanogenarians, because we've had people like Paul Dooley and Carl Reiner, William Daniels on the show, all in their 90s. But, man, they're all great, and they all still tell fantastic stories.
Yeah, and I've had those two also, Carl Reiner and Paul Dooley. We never got William Daniels, but we got Dick Van Dyke was
yes.
on the show.
And that was great. Yeah, and you sang with him. How wonderful was that?
Yeah, supercalifragilistic and put on a happy face. And at one point, he started to advise me. He goes, okay, when you get to this part, it's a D, and you lower. And then he said, forget it.
We love the documentary that came out about you a couple of years ago. Was it hard for you to let people behind the curtain a little bit into that aspect of your life?
That was horrible. I should remember his name now. That would be good. The filmmaker, Neil Berkeley.
Yes.
Neil Berkeley came up to me, and he said, I'm a filmmaker. I've always dreamt of doing a Gilbert Gottfried documentary. And I said, well, you should set your dreams a lot higher than that. And he started following me around with a camera, and I didn't interfere with it. I didn't say no. But I hated him following me with the camera, and I hated watching the film. But all the reviews were great, and it is. It's like, and it's, we talk about it in the film. I always think of that scene in Wizard of Oz, where it's like, ignore that man behind the curtain. Because I always feel like that's it. If you let someone behind the curtain, then it ruins everything.
And you talked about how your life is to you, even now, it's a bit surreal. And I kept in watching, I kept thinking of the old Talking Head song, "This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife."
Exactly. And I say there, too, it's like, you know, those Twilight Zone episodes that were a million with that same premise, where someone wakes up and goes, what is this house? And what am I doing here? Why, you're the president, sir. And it's 1843, you know.
My son is turning six today, and I'm 61 years old. I had my son, my first, at 55. You came to parenthood late in life as well. Are you better at it now than you would have been back in your 20s or 30s or even 40s?
I think I'm equally bad. But I find the weirdest thing about being a parent is that I can't reprimand my kids if they say a dirty word. Because there's no way I can look at them with a straight face and say, no, you shouldn't say that.
But when the time comes that they're old enough and you can teach them how to string some words together like nobody else around, man, what a great role model you'll be.
They can take over the family business. I'll be obscene and disgusting.
Well, Gilbert, it's wonderful to talk with you. We are a big fan of your career for so long. We wish you well on your trip to Rumford. When you come up here to Maine, I hope the hotel has lots of good. What are you going to do when they start getting rid of these little...
That's horrible. They've been getting rid of the handout little soaps and shampoos.
Why would they do that?
I hate that.
Yes.
Oh, before I forget, just jumping off on another plug.
Please do.
I'm also on Cameo.com, where I send out video messages. You could get your own personalized video message from me on Cameo.com.
Absolutely. And there's a link to that on your website as well if people would like more information. Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you well, and hope to see you back here on the show again with us down the road.
Oh, thank you.
That's Gilbert Gottfried. He'll be appearing in Rumford January 30th at 49 Franklin Reception Hall and Mystic Theater. And, man, if you get a chance to see Gilbert on stage, you take advantage of it. Our thanks to Gilbert, thanks to Michael Sokolow, and the humble but nonetheless mighty John Marshall. And, of course, thanks to you for visiting with us as well on your Sunday morning. Brought to you, as always, by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Join us on the program tomorrow. We talk Baseball Hall of Fame, a guy who knows the qualifications better than anybody, the inventor of Jaws, Jay Jaffe of Fangraphs, plus movie reviews from Alan Adams of The Maine Edge and a whole lot more. Coming up this week on the show, lots of our regulars, of course, and we'll talk with the Prairie Bitch herself. Not me calling her this, the title of her autobiography, her memoirs, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, actor Allison Arngrim from Little House on the Prairie, that pain in the butt Nelly. She'll join us coming up in the week ahead here on Downtown. Hope the rest of your Sunday goes well. We'll see you next time on Z62 Retro Radio. Downtown, you're gonna-